It may not look like it, but we do know where we're going in all of the teaching that we are doing. For example, we were teaching on Stonehenge and linking it to the pyramid. Now, I find it absolutely unbelievable that if you take this Stonehenge circle, here is a reconstruction of it as it, in artist conception, would have looked. And you see there's a horseshoe of high trilithons looking, let me get a pencil, Mike, looking out in this direction. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 trilithons. Then inside another horseshoe circle of blue stones. Then a complete circle of blue stones that goes all the way around. And then the covered lintel sarsen circle. Then way out is a ditch. And inside the ditch, holes that are called Aubrey holes. Standing at a given spot in the center of one of these circles, looking across the numbered blue stones siding to each of these Aubrey holes, you can divide the circle into units that measure out days and weeks and months and years. You have a 7,000-year calendar. Interestingly enough, you take another picture, which is a drawing of the whole circle, if I can get it on camera. I just drew an arrow coming out of that artist replica that comes out this direction to the right, that goes through an opening in the ditch, sights over a hailstone to the summer solstice, that point of the longest day of the year, which is marked by that. Directly perpendicular to that, rectangular lines connect four marker stones, 91, 92, 93, 94. You draw a diagonal line from 93 to 91 and keep it going all the way as a line. Just start walking and keep walking, you'll hit the pyramid. Now that to me is interesting. Particularly when, as I've been teaching, here's a shot of it, diagramming that I've just drawn. Stone 93, station stone, draw the line through station stone 91, goes right on down to the pyramid. You draw this line that's perpendicular from the center of the circles to the summer solstice, and then take the same spot and draw a line zeroed in on true north, and you have an angle that is the exact angle of the pyramid, which means you could draw your pyramid and on scale set the whole study. You folks on radio, you're watching me as I find these things. Hold your breath. I'm going to find you a drawing. Should have marked it. You see, I have two copies of this book. One of them I have marked, and one of them I don't have marked. You place the circle of the Stonehenge monument with the Aubrey circle, which are the little holes out inside the ditch that become the markers that you cite through the blue stones too for your dates on a 7,000-year circle. You put this Stonehenge in scale and slice this center section of the pyramid, as we've said, right through the center of it, and lay it down on the ground where the Stonehenge circle is, with the left corner of that sliced triangle that is the pyramid in exact scale in the center of the sarsen circle. The Aubrey circle's out here. Draw your lines. It will perfectly coincide You draw a line from the breakout point of the well shaft in the pyramid, which opens up the grand gallery, which is the death and resurrection of Christ. And you draw a line which is equidistant from the center point to where the well shaft starts lifting itself up from the descending passage. Connect those lines to the circle. You come to two dates. The date when Enoch was 33 and a half years old, and 33 and a half on the Sarsen circle, which marks the death and resurrection of Christ. Now, not only did the Aubrey circle and the Stonehenge chronometer. Now, not only did Stonehenge line up with the pyramid, its dimensions give you the exact angle of the pyramid. This turns out to be the Christ angle, which we find in the pyramid. Again and again, as I dig into it, we're going to find a common architect or a common builder was involved. Not only do those blue stones, when we stand in the center of the circle and sight the blue stones in on the Aubrey circle out there, sighting through the trilithons, each trilithon, hold steady, Mike, and I'll see if I can go back to the artist drawing. The trilithons are the five highest monumental stones at Stonehenge reconstructed. They consist of two uprights with a lintel stone, like the Sarsen circle has lintel stones and uprights. Each of these are positioned in such a way that you can mark the sunrise, the moonrise. There's the great central trilithon that you sight through toward the summer solstice, the moonset trilithon and the sunset trilithon. These are set up in such a way that they mark on the calendar sunrise and moonrise and moonset and sunset. You suddenly have another calendar spring loose. And as you mark the dates on the trilithons, you will end up with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 additional dates as you sight through to the moonrise or moonset or sunrise or sunset that is involved. It too will cross the Aubrey circle at a given point. 2593 BC is the first one. 2571 BC is the second one. 2251 BC is the third. 627 B.C. is the fourth. 539 A.D., 918 A.D., 962 A.D. Now, what are those dates and what makes them significant? Just to let you know, I know where I'm going. I'm telling you, there are still some things to talk about on this subject. That's why you have to have your Stonehenge book, so I can show you. Are you going to tell us what those dates are tonight? Well, the first one. Tell you the first one. That's nicer than I normally am. First one, 2593 B.C. What are you standing back there for? 2593 B.C. There are some people who say that that is exactly the date that God passed the divine sentence on the human race and told them the flood was going to happen. But we'll check that out. Now, all of the things, you got that, didn't you? The date God passed sentence on mankind, says he's going to wipe them out. Just plucked out of the sky? Nope. Sighted in Stonehenge. Now, there are so many things that we are dealing with. We have talked about the lost tribes, but there's a reason for that. We've talked about the pyramid and how we're delving into Stonehenge. We have hinted at Atlantis. All of this teaching started when we said we're going to teach verse by verse through the book of Genesis. Now, I have one purpose in teaching, to show that God's in control. I listen to Christian evangelicals beating the drum about evolution's going to conquer the church. They don't say it that way, but they sure sound like it. I mean, I see the church world scared, spitless about evolution. I had a mother ask the other night, should we send our kids to public school if we can teach them at home? I'd say, yeah. They'll get a better education on most things at public school. I'm a product of public school. I didn't lose my faith. When's the church world going to get off the defensive? Listen to me. Evolution is a hypothesis. All that they will ever be able to do is demonstrate close proximity of factual events that support the hypothesis. You can go sit down. And when Darwin conquered the world with the evolutionary theory, it moved over into social philosophy, into psychology, social psychology, and it began to dominate every dimension of learning until the fallacious concept developed that man has been progressing. Now, liberalism built on that and made us believe that education was salvation and man would usher in the millennium with his own knowledge. Because man is getting ever better. No, he isn't. Now, we talked about the Dogon people. Remember that? Down in Africa. They worship a little star that is a white dwarf. Can't be seen with the naked eye. Yet these primitive savages in Mali, primitive savages in quote, have built their entire religious calendar around the 50-year cycle orbit of that white dwarf now known in modern astronomy as Sirius B, the orbital white dwarf that goes around the dog star, Sirius A it's now called, 50-year elliptical circuitry. Now I'm going ahead of my story, but these Dogon people call that tiny star Potolo. Potolo is a cereal grain. Its botanical name is Digitaria exilis. It's sometimes called by astronomers Digitaria. We don't have the grain Po. It was picked by these natives of Central Africa because it's the smallest grain they know. The orbit of Digitaria, they believe, this star that couldn't be seen by the naked eye, is at the center of the world. Now, modern astronomy discovered it, as we said, teaching back many weeks ago, when an astronomer noticed that the dog star Sirius was wobbling, and he concluded there must be some giant star going around it, but there wasn't. It's a little star. Now, these poor people, the Dogons, they believe that the starting point of creation is the star which revolves around Sirius. It is regarded by the Dogon as the smallest and heaviest of all the stars. How did they know that? The white dwarf is a recent discovery. Couldn't be seen. Modern astronomy see Sirius wobbling. Now they name it Sirius A because they've discovered not a giant star that's going around it, but a white dwarf. So compacted that, as I said last night, the 747 were to land on it, it'd just flatten like a pancake because of the gravity instantly. Yet these four tribes, primarily the Dogon, but four tribes in Mali, Central Africa, knew all of this. They said it's the smallest and heaviest of all stars. It contains the germs of all things in the universe. Its movement on its own axes and around Sirius upholds all creation in space. That's what their liturgy says. It determined their liturgical calendar. And they drew pictures of the orbit. And with Sirius A as the foci. They knew all about Saturn, but that's more explainable. The Sigwi among the Dogon is celebrated every 60 years. When I tell you the importance of that 60-year cycle and how they got it from astronomy, it'll blow your mind. The Dogon say that 60 is the count of the cosmic placenta, where the universe is born. They have a rite of circumcision that they relate and diagram in the orbit of this invisible star. The bright star, Sirius, that can be seen with the naked eye, is not as important to the Dogon as the tiny Sirius B. The Dogon also know the actual orbital period of this invisible star. 50 years. Can't see it, and yet they know its orbit and the shape of the orbit. The most amazing of all the Dogen statements in their liturgy is that Poe is the smallest thing there is, yet it's the heaviest star. They have four kinds of calendar. One built around Sirius. They say the orbit of Digitaria or Potolo is at the center of the world. Digitaria is the axis of the whole world, and without its movement, no other star could hold its course, they say. Sirius played the role of great central fire for our sun. They go on, how do they know all this? Now, I haven't done it for you, but you trace the history of these Dogon people. It'll lead you up to the northern rim of Africa, and about 4,000 B.C. take you all the way back to Egypt, even before the flood. How did this heritage pass on to them? Now, what am I reading from? Not the Sirius Mystery, which I was reading the other night. One of the most interesting books is John Anthony West, Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt. The Sphinx is his subject. Now, maybe some of you know about this fella. R. A. Schwaller de Lubitz. The thesis of de Lubitz is that the builders of ancient Egypt had far more sophisticated understanding than most Egyptologists have been willing to admit. R. A. Schwaller, who in real life was knighted de Lubitz by the Lithuanian prince Luzas de Lubitz for his contribution to the liberation of Lithuania from both the Russians and the Germans at the end of World War I, attained fame for taking on all the Egyptologists and all of these lists of dynasties and kings. Now, this guy, Jonathan Anthony West, decides to resurrect his theories. And his theories are very simple. I can go through some of the most complicated discussions you've ever read, but this is it in a nutshell. Every aspect of Egyptian knowledge seems to have been complete at the very beginning. Now, when that Broussard bent over and looked at that Rosetta Stone, and Champollion eventually cracked hieroglyphics and came to see that it was an alphabet, not picture writing per se, and the knowledge of Egypt began to unfold. History entrenched itself and kept perpetuating the same error. And you can read textbook after textbook will tell you the Egyptians progressed from something. The thesis of this book is every aspect of Egyptian knowledge, and this is fact, this is not a thesis, seems to have been complete at the very beginning. Hieroglyphics didn't evolve. The earliest ones found are complete. The sciences, artistic and architectural techniques, the hieroglyphic systems show no signs of a period of development. Indeed, many of the achievements of the earliest dynasties were never surpassed or even equaled later on. How does a complex civilization spring full-blown into being? Look at a 1905 automobile and compare it to a modern one. There's no mistaking the process of development. It's obvious as you look at a long stream that's been flowing. But in Egypt, there are no parallels. Everything is there right at the start. The answer to the mystery is, of course, obvious. Repellent to the prevailing caste of modern thinking, it is seldom seriously considered because progressive evolution dominates. Egyptian civilization was not a development. It was a legacy. Somebody gave it to them full-orbed. The Dogon people did not discover Sirius B. The knowledge was given to them. And here they are in Central Africa drawing pictures of a star they couldn't see and its orbit. Somebody gave it to them. Who? And one of the most fascinating things about Egypt is their ability to produce inlaid eyes in mummies and statuary. You know about that, don't you? Look at this picture. Just look at it. And if you think the picture's overpowering, it's amazing when you see one actually. The Egyptian technique for producing inlaid eyes reached the height of its perfection in the 4th dynasty and was never equaled subsequently either in Egypt or anywhere else in the world. The Egyptians must have taken careful note of reflection and refraction properties of the material used. The result, even in a photograph, is striking. In person, it's practically overpowering. Of the examples found to date, listen close, more are blue or gray-eyed than brown-eyed. Hey, I'm not carrying a torch for the color of eyes. I'm talking about where these people come from. Can this have anything to do with the long, supposedly legendary rule of Egypt prior to Menes by the Venerables of the North? Now, heaven is always considered to be north. Always. And heaven is always considered to be a mountain. On a Sunday morning, a couple of years ago, I figured out my congregation wasn't ready yet, so I preached one sermon, had fun with it, and then dropped it. One of the most fascinating studies ever written by anybody is David N. Talbot's booklet on the Saturn myth. When you study hieroglyphics, ancient hieroglyphics, and ancient sun worship worldwide, they don't worship the sun and moon as we now know it. It has been transferred until later mythological worshipers who worship the sun would worship the sun as we see it, Baal worshipers. Semiramis would translate it to that, for example. But the earliest hieroglyphics show that it was not the sun as we know it that is the root in hieroglyphic language of the worship of the sun, but rather Saturn. Saturn was the worship center with the rings around it. Later on, transferred to the sun that we see every day. Why? Likewise, every religion in the world, you say, you know where you're going? Sure do. People watch me, usually find out I come out on the corner, right? Every single religion in the world worships a cosmic mountain. Now, this whole study by Talbot is a different approach to truth. It is almost exclusively limited to hieroglyphic signs in the heritage of all mankind. Their earliest attempts to express their religious faith. They all have a cosmic mountain they worship. Where was that mountain? And the cosmic mountain always has the image of the enclosed sun or the enclosed sun cross on it. And they look like this, if you can get a close-up. An enclosed sun, like Saturn with its rings, resting on its perch, the holy mountain, or the enclosed sun with the enclosed sun cross resting on its perch. Now, missionaries have sometimes gone to remote places, and when they have seen people using the symbol of the cross, they just go banana boat. Jesus got there first. The cross did not originate with Calvary, my friend. It didn't originate there. It originated in remotest time. You got to see it almost third dimensional, where from the source of life itself, in some viewpoints, the breath of God would flow four directions to cover the earth. And it translates in later thinking to four rivers that bring life going four directions. And as the source of life that flows from God, the cross became a symbol. Now again, like all symbols distorted by Satan and distorted in heathen mythology, it becomes evil in its nature and can become even the root in its evil twist of the swastika bent out of shape. The cross didn't originate with Christianity. But by the same token, neither do I agree. There's one place I disagree with Hislop, that the cross is a heathen symbol. The cross antedated heathenism, was bent out of shape the way Satan does, and put back in shape by Christ. Cross is one I won't yield to the heathens. But in the most remotest of antiquity, there was a holy mountain with the symbol of Saturn and the source of rivers and winds from God on top of that mountain. Now, we all know the earth before the flood was different. And I showed you last night from ancient mariners' maps, this marvelous map, Perry Reyes' map. Reyes means Admiral Perry, one of his names. And this marvelous map, discovered, painted on parchment, found in 1929 in the old Imperial Palace in Constantinople, signed with the name of Piri Ibn Haji Mehmed, an admiral of the Turkish Navy, opened up a study of 7 years that to me proved absolutely and conclusively that long before Columbus, this map mapped the Atlantic Ocean when the connections between Antarctica, I got sneeze. Hey, what else would you do? Not everybody can sneeze so gracefully on television. This is the Iberian Peninsula. Can you get in here close, Mike? This is the Iberian Peninsula, this old map. Here's the Straits of Gibraltar. Here's that African area. The Dogons are right in here, by the way. You go across to the other side. This is the Atlantic Ocean. Here's the Caribbean coast. Here is Brazil and on down South America. Here's the Falklands and here's the Shetland Islands. The connections are complete. They aren't yet severed.
This is the end of side one.